Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. As we have been covering here in recent days, one of the hottest flashpoints in that war is what is taking place in Egypt at the moment. In the course of what we think of as the 4th of July holiday weekend here, of course, there have been a lot of developments, and to catch up on them, we are delighted to welcome back to this microphone Dr. Barry Rubin. He is the director of the Gloria Center in Herzliya, Israel, a man who has literally written the book on the Muslim Brotherhood, as well as Israel, An Introduction, his most recent work. Barry Rubin, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You are stateside, I understand, and we're looking forward to seeing you a little bit later in the week. But I wanted to catch up with you as quickly as we could to get your sense of what is happening at the moment in Egypt, where we've seen, of course, Mohamed Morsi removed from power by the military, and an increasing evidence that this is not going to sit well with the Muslim Brotherhood. What do you expect to come?
Well, lots of things in the short run and lots of things in the long run. First of all, clearly the military is determined. They are not in the mood to. They've gone too far. They've shot people down. So they're serious about this. And they're not going to withdraw this. Secondly, what we don't know is the military's plans. It seems that they are talking about bringing in the former opposition, and in part perhaps as a cover, so that they can claim that they're democratic too, but perhaps because they mean it. And so we have the return of Mohamed al-Baradei, who's not good news. His question is whether he can run the country. I don't see any reason to believe he can. His ongoing radicalism, his past association with the Muslim Brotherhood. But again, I said, maybe they really don't mean it. Maybe this is to say, okay, well, we put the opposition into power, so we are really doing the democratic thing. And thirdly of all, and most simple of all, is the Brotherhood itself and Salafists. And, I mean, I think the Salafists, many of the Salafists will fight, and perhaps some of the Brotherhood will. But I don't think what the Brotherhood does is interesting. I think what's interesting is what the army does and what also, of course, Obama does. Now, we may be faced with an unbelievable situation in which, after having quickly dumped the Mubarak administration, which has a 30-year record of friendliness to the U.S., they are going to really press. The Obama administration is going to really press the protection and defense of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, this certainly, Barry Rubin, would fit with their past practice of doing everything they can to empower and legitimate and ultimately help secure the leadership of Egypt.
But they're going much further than I think people imagined. I mean, what are they going to do? Demand the return of the Brotherhood? I mean, what they've done so far is, well, there's three things. First of all, it's a very bland thing. We want to have a new elections as quickly as possible. Of course, if you examine this, it's ridiculous, because what's happened is that the army has voided elections. So now we say, oh, we want more elections. And so that's just a silly diplomatic thing. But I think presidents in the past could have done better. Secondly of all, they're saying they're neutral. They're not taking any side. But of course, they are taking a side, because they have said that they want the Brotherhood to participate in the government, which, by the way, was exactly what was said in early 2011. This is unbelievable. They want to force the military to get rid of a very dangerous enemy who the military has gotten rid of. I mean, they're going to try to keep the Brotherhood in a part of the government. I don't think no U.S. government has ever gone so far. But finally, there's a little quote in a Bloomberg article that is earth-shattering to me. And here is what roughly the story. They interview two officials of the National Security Council who didn't give their names. I think they didn't give them because they were ashamed. And this is what they said. We are following this. And by the way, I don't want to give all the details, but it's clearly following what President Obama has said privately. So what they say is this. We are against the policy of the military because, number one, it can't work. They can't win. And number two, if you fight the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists, they will become more militant and more terrorists, and they will follow an al-Qaeda strategy. Now, this is all along what I said is Brennan's viewpoint. I mean, they're really saying that, first of all, you cannot beat the Islamists. You just, why try? And secondly, they're saying we have to help the Islamists because otherwise they may have September 11th type terrorist attacks in the United States. Now, what that tells you is that this is a surrender and appeasement policy, that they have concluded that the Islamists are so strong, you have to give them to them or else they will attack you. This is, it's unimaginable to me, even given what we've gone through before, that U.S. government policy could be set on such a basis.
Yeah. Barry Rubin is our guest again. He is a professor at the Interdisciplinary Center at Herzliya, Israel, and director of the Global Research in International Affairs, or GLORIA Center, at the IDC. He is also the editor of the Middle East Review of International Affairs and a member of the editorial board of the Middle East Quarterly. And Barry Rubin, just to drill down on this bit, you've described, I think, quite eloquently the nightmare that may now be unfolding if the Obama administration persists in its support of the Muslim Brotherhood. Let me ask you about
But now we know publicly why they're doing it. They're doing it because they're afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood. American president.
Yeah, either that they're afraid of them or they are so deeply in bed with them that they want to propound this idea that they are unstoppable, that they're the rising force, and that as they've dressed it up, that they're the counterweight to al-Qaeda, which, of course, as you've written in your book, is nonsense.
I think people are.
Yeah, let me just ask you about this because, Barry, I think it's the sort of operational point. When we talk about these, you know, aspirations for democracy, can we, in fact, pursue democracy if that means including people who fundamentally are anti-democratic? They are hostile to democracy and would simply use it, as the Brotherhood has, and certainly I think was intent on doing in Egypt as well, to secure power and then destroy whatever, you know, fledgling roots of democracy there might be.
Yes, the United States and any country must look after its interests first, especially when it is faced with a situation which might involve elections, but which someone sensible will see that it's going to break down into chaos and violence. That is the basis of statehood. The purpose of foreign policy is not to spread democracy, especially temporary democracy, especially elected dictatorship. It is to secure the interests of the United States. And may I point out, people have forgotten that right after the beginning of the Cold War, the U.S. was involved in trying to help the moderate democratic forces win in elections in France and Italy. There are many examples of such in history. In the U.S. history, I've just participated in the reenactment of the Civil War, and the fact is that the Confederacy was democratically the state legislatures voted on secession. So, and those were legally elected. So the idea that, you know, you're going to bow to elections, so you will watch while an unrepentant Nazi collaborator of the Muslim Brotherhood is playing the power. And when I say that, by the way, I have the documents, so I'm going to publish soon about this. They have not changed the policy since that time. You don't commit suicide, and you do not serve your people, of your citizens of your country, by committing suicide. This is not the way things have ever worked before. And at any rate, we don't have a reason to believe that these elected governments are frankly going to last very long anyway.
I couldn't agree with you more. Barry Rubin, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for joining us. Welcome back to the United States. It's good to have you. We'll look forward to seeing you later in the week. Next up, we'll take stock of all of these issues with Adam Kratom of the Washington Free Beacon. Straight ahead.
I want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by Adam Kratom, one of our stars here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is also a senior writer at the Washington Free Beacon, a man who formerly worked at the Washington Jewish Week, a prize-winning journalist, and a guy who covers very well some of the most interesting of the beats that we're focused on, including what's happening in Egypt. Adam, great to have you with us. As always, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You had a piece that I want to come to today in the Washington Free Beacon about the response of the United States government to the events in Egypt. We've just taken stock a little bit of those with Barry Rubin, but I'd like to get your sense as well as to what has happened there. Is it in fact a coup in your estimation, Adam Credo, and what are the implications for U.S. government policy if it should be deemed as such?
Right. Well, that is what's interesting here. The response so far, there's been none, but the law, U.S. law, actually dictates a response given what happened there. The military deposed the president. That, by definition, seems to be a coup. And under U.S. law, aid to a country that experiences this must be cut off and reauthorized by Congress. And that's what some lawmakers are calling on President Obama to do. We know very well that he's accommodated the Muslim Brotherhood the time that they were in there, more than $1.3 billion in U.S. Military aid and then economic aid on top of that. And all of that under the law looks like it should be cut off. But of course, as experts and others have pointed out to me, there are always loopholes when it comes to this.
Well, there's loopholes, and there's also some concerted argument being made, notably, as you wrote about, by Congressman Mike Rogers, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, that you know, we need to find a way to fix this, make it kosher, if you will, in the Congress, but it would be a bad idea to cut off the funding. Senator John McCain, who I've come to be calling Obamacane these days because they seem to be joined at the hip, arguing to the contrary that the aid should be cut off. We're joined by Washington Free Beacon senior writer Adam Credo, the man who covers brilliantly, I might add, the national security beat at the Beacon. We were talking a little bit, Adam, about whether and if so, how the United States government might respond to this so-called coup in Egypt, and specifically the argument that the law makes it pretty clear, if it is such a thing, and it seems to be by most definitions of the term, that funding would have to be suspended, and not just military assistance, but all kinds of assistance. This would presumably further devastate what is already a parlous situation in the Egyptian economy at the moment. Where do you think the Obama administration comes down on this idea? We heard a little bit from Barry Rubin about it, but I'd like to get your sense as well, Adam Credo.
Well, look, given the Obama administration's past interactions with the Muslim Brotherhood, very close to them, and as others have pointed out, inviting Muslim Brotherhood affiliated officials here to D.C. to meet at the White House, it looks like they would likely stand by the Muslim Brotherhood, calling it the democratically elected government. And the question still is, was this a coup or was it a revolution? The people were on the street. There were violent clashes. But at the end of the day, the military intervened, the powerful Egyptian military, which does indicate a coup there. And of course, the military for the future, as far as we can see now, is going to be appointing and overseeing everybody who comes into the political system. So they're effectively running the country. So the question is, what does the president do in this case? Does he cut off this aid, or does he stand by the Muslim Brotherhood and continue to try and see it as the legitimately elected government? There are indications they could choose the latter, I think.
Yeah. Well, as Barry pointed out, and it's quite ominous, really, the Bloomberg had a report with unnamed National Security Council officials, Adam, in which they intimated that the military simply cannot win in this struggle with the Muslim Brotherhood, and that if it were to try to persist in repressing them, that it would simply have the effect of making the Brotherhood and other Salafists aligned with it even more violent, and that would be a bad thing all the way around. Let me ask you this, Adam, because I don't know that this question has really received much conversation thus far, but one of the things that seems to be pretty much uniformly agreed is that whatever comes next must include the Muslim Brotherhood at a minimum. If it's it's not fully restored, that it must stand for new elections and presumably be part of any future more inclusive government. But Adam, you've studied these guys pretty closely for a long time. My view of these folks are that they have no interest in democracy, and that any government that includes them or any electoral process that involves them is really the old one man, one vote, one time story, isn't it?
Well, look, there certainly is evidence that that's what they would like to do. And the evidence was the Morsi presidency, as far as I can tell, where they consolidated powers, where they really took control of the government and ran roughshod over all of their opponents. And any government that includes the Muslim Brotherhood will include a Muslim Brotherhood that is trying to carry out its agenda. And that's what its agenda is, to consolidate power and run the country in the way it sees fit and the way it had been before they were taken out of power. So I think that's what we need to pay attention to before we start discussing including the Muslim Brotherhood in any future government or what role they should exactly play going forward.
Yeah, it certainly seems to me it's going to be a formula for more of the same, more of the effort to impose Sharia, less inclusiveness and so on, certainly less democratic government in Egypt and, for that matter, any place else they are able to obtain power with or without our help. Adam Credo is our guest from the Washington Free Beacon. Adam, you were kind enough to join us for a press conference last week that I wanted also to visit with you about. This was an event that the center sponsored involving a number of eminent figures on the Samantha Power nomination to become the next UN ambassador from the United States. I'd be interested in your takeaway from it. You wrote about it in the Free Beacon, but what was the message as you perceived it?
I did cover it, and it was a good one to be at, and I appreciate you guys holding it. And this is what I think the significant takeaway is, and this is what people also are not paying attention to when it comes to Samantha Power, that the areas of concern, the areas that really get national security figures, military leaders, pro-Israel leaders all together are numerable, that it's the Israel front that she's criticized Israel massively, that she's criticized American power, that she does not appreciate America's role in the world and what its role traditionally has been in the world, a role and force of good in the world. She's also advocated an apology tour at the United Nations. It's a combination of factors that have senior and very prominent officials from across the spectrum coming together against her. That's what I think is interesting here, that it's a wide range of people galvanized in opposition.
Well, I think that's right, and I'm hoping that that will be more and more in evidence in the days ahead. And one of those who participated in that press conference, of course, was Ambassador Jose Sorzano, who formerly served, as you know, with Jean Kirkpatrick at the United Nations when she was really an exemplary U.S. representative to that body. And I pray that what we will find coming out of the conversation that we had last week and what will be the confirmation hearings that will be held sometime in the next 2 weeks will be more and more of an understanding that we don't really need a representative of the United Nations to the United States. That is to say, somebody who fully embraces their agenda and their anti-Americanism and their efforts to impose on our sovereignty in ways that diminish it. But we need somebody who will actually stand up for us, as Jean Kirkpatrick did. Adam Credo, you stand up for us every day. Thank you very much for doing so at the Washington Free Beacon. Keep up the good work, if you will. We look forward to talking with you again in the very near future. Next up, Dr. Ken DeGraffenried, former senior official in the Reagan administration, will tell us what he makes of the Snowden affair and Egypt and much, much more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Great Britain has just deported a jihadist Jordanian cleric known as Abu Qatada. He had spent some 12 years in court, fighting to remain in the UK and continue promoting the Islamic supremacist agenda of Sharia. The fact that this Islamist was able to string things out so long is particularly astounding since way back in 2005, the British government declared that Abu Qatada, quote, poses a continuing threat to national security and a significant terrorism-related risk to the public, unquote. The same could be said of Islamists in this country, who espouse what the Muslim Brotherhood calls civilization jihadist techniques to destroy our country from within. The U.S. government should apply the Qatada option by removing those jihadists from our shores. But in light of the threat they represent, do it far faster. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, joined by a man I have had the privilege of knowing and working with for decades. And there are a few people that I would think of as his peer when it comes to the service to our country, both in uniform, that of a naval aviator in the very important business of anti-submarine warfare back in the day, a professor, now Professor Emeritus at the Institute of World Politics, a man who served in a number of different capacities in the civilian side of the government as well, the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Support, and also as a senior official in the Office of the National Counterintelligence Executive, and not least on the National Security Council staff of President Reagan, where he was responsible for intelligence programs. With all of these credentials, Ken DeGraffenreid, it is a high privilege to have a chance to talk with you about a couple of things that I know are weighing on you and certainly are weighing on us. Welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. I'm pleased to be here.
Let's talk first and foremost about Edward Snowden. What do you make of this as a longtime intelligence professional, Ken, particularly from a counterintelligence professional's perspective? How do we get into this fix, and do we see any end in sight?
Well, it's like the old story about how a man went bankrupt. He said slowly at first and then very quickly. I think many of these things that, and I think the Snowden case is a bouillabaisse of failures, bad judgment, bad policy. And I think if you reach in and pull out a morsel, you know, it reveals enormous things about how we got to this. Let's start with a couple. First of all, on its surface, I think as everybody is aware, the Snowden case may rank as one of the worst cases of espionage in American history by volume and by access. I mean, if you carry out four laptops full of data from NSA, you've done us grievous damage. I mean, the good thing about the pre-information period, it was hard to schlep a giant safe out the door. You could get a few documents. But this is terrible, and I do want to say something about that. But if you look a little deeper at this thing, first it reveals a terrible security problem. I mean, when we left paper and went to the information age solution, and the Bob Gateses and all the rest said, "Oh no, this is the way to protect ourselves." Well, it would have been the way to protect ourselves if we had protected ourselves. But when a third-rate contractor, fifth-rate contractor, whatever you want to call them, is able to get to secrets that, when I was in the business, only a handful of officials would have had access to, and not access in that amount. This Bradley Manning character did it. Snowden has done it, and goodness knows how many others have done it who did not have the narcissistic desire for flamboyance that these others did.
Or have not fully revealed the extent of their
right.
their perfidy.
Right.
Ken, this raises an interesting question. We've been told in recent days that there is evidence that perhaps Snowden may have had help from inside the NSA, or perhaps even inside the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Do you think that likely as an explanation for how the fifth or third, even third-rate contractor might have had access to so much very sensitive material?
I do, Frank, and I mean, it can run the gamut from state-sponsored, that is, the FSB or the MSS, the Russian and Chinese intelligence services were at work doing this, because this is certainly not beyond them to concoct this kind of an outing of this information. But it also reveals, I think, maybe I won't say at the other end of the spectrum, but what we have with the rise of what I call the Leviathans, that is, the people of the bureaucracy, the fourth branch of government of the administrative state, who hold no particular allegiance to the United States and believe their job is to wage these campaigns from inside to reveal alleged wrongdoing or things that they don't like. And I mean, Snowden himself is, I hate to put a political spin on it, but he is the perfect Obama voter. Young, hip, edgy, tech-savvy, and narcissistic. And I have to fear, and that's the real word, that there are many more like him. Because obviously our security reviews, personnel security reviews, and our counterintelligence have not tumbled to the fact that these people are not the loyal Americans of your average 25-year-old when you and I were entering this.
Yeah. Business. And let me ask you on that question. And again, our guest is Ken DeGraffenreid. He is a professor emeritus at the Institute of World Politics and a longtime member of the senior ranks of the United States government in particular in connection with intelligence and counterintelligence activities. And Ken, one of the really troubling bits about this story has been the evidence that's come to light that the clearance process, whereby background checks are conducted and interviews and so on, seems to have broken down rather dramatically. Is that a factor in this, or is it simply that the system hasn't, as you say, understood adequately the nature of the problem that they may be now obliged to screen for?
The answer to that is yes. I mean, the whole background investigation process, which was never a five-inch case-hardened steel protection to begin with, has gone steadily downhill for the last 20 or 30 years. So, and now it's farmed out to contractors. I do a lot of this, you know, because of my students. I'm always being interviewed by these people, and I am, you know, I shake my head in wonderment of the kind of people they have doing the background investigations.
Yeah.
Absolutely clueless.
Yeah. I had an interesting conversation with one of our former colleagues with whom you worked at IWP, who told me that one of his students was actually involved in this screening process and was in tears because she was involved, obliged to perform a quota system whereby what amounted to something like 20 different background clearances had to be approved each day. And it's obvious to anybody who knows anything about this business, you can't possibly do a competent job, let alone a rigorous one, under those circumstances.
Mechanically, it's a shambles, and it's very poorly done. But then when you add to that that there is no understanding of who a risk might be. If you don't see a Snowden character as somebody who is not a trustworthy person with the nation's secrets, and for the reasons that he isn't, this identity with the international left, an apparently abiding anti-Americanism, and if that is not something that rings a bell, and those aren't the things, by the way, that people ask questions about. They want to know, about his finances and stuff. This guy does not appear to have done this, quote, for the money. And the security process has been stuck on the money thing for the last, I know, at least for the last 25 years. And it's true that some people spy for money. But the ones that have damaged the United States have spied for what we might call ideological or political reasons. And, when you cannot mention, you cannot write the word jihad inside the intelligence community, when you cannot acknowledge the nature of the current struggle, either the international left or the Islamists, and you cannot talk about those things, it's very difficult to see how one could develop a screening process. But counterintelligence, which is the other half of our protection, we're Americans. Security is never going to be our number one strength. But we have made up, or tried to make up for that, with good counterintelligence. Today we have no counterintelligence to speak of, in part because of this fourth branch of government, Leviathans, Angelo Cotevilla's, a subset of his ruling class, people who simply find counterintelligence because it challenges received wisdom, it challenges the so-called politically correct cultural Marxism of things, is seen as a danger to bureaucrats. And they kill off.
Not as a danger to the country. Ken, we have to leave it at that. We've got so much more to talk with you about on Egypt and Samantha Power and other topics. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, thank you for your service to our country, past, present, and continuing. Keep it up and stay well. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll take stock of the competition with China in Africa. And are we, in fact, in the game? Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaevs' kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we are each week, I'm very pleased to say, by Gordon Chang, the guy who is our duty expert on Asia and that of so many others, including Forbes'
Newsweek.com, where he has a column, World Affairs Journal, where he's a regular contributor, and Fox News, not least, where he is really the duty guy on Asian matters. Gordon, welcome back. It's always good to have you. I hope you had a good 4th of July.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Let's pick up where I just left off with Ken DeGraffenreid. We were talking about, from the perspective of a kind of counterintelligence meltdown, the possibility that this guy was not operating entirely alone. It's bad enough if that were the case, but that there may have been help provided to him. I know in the past you've speculated that the Chinese may have been giving him some cueing or perhaps even some other assistance. That theory seems to be gaining currency, perhaps if only through people who are sympathetic to China, who are also still inside the National Security Agency. Do you have any further thoughts on that, Gordon? I'm fascinated by this possibility.
You know, many people have speculated that Snowden had access to all sorts of information that he could not have otherwise gotten on his own. And it, very well, he may have been able to defeat systems at NSA, but it's more likely that there were others at NSA who were working for China who gave information to Snowden. Snowden essentially was a Dropbox. He was meant to be the courier, and that's exactly what it did. There are also people telling me, though this is, remains unconfirmed, that Snowden left Hawaii in a rush because Chinese intelligence, either directly or through FBI agents who had been turned by China, had told Snowden that NSA investigators were closing in on him. We know that when Snowden was in Hong Kong, that he lied about his contacts with Chinese officials. He said he didn't have any in the Guardian chat. And actually he did, because Chinese officials encouraged him to have those that interview with the South China Morning Post, where he turned over detailed technical information to the Post, including internet protocol addresses that had been surveilled by NSA. If he had not been a traitor before, this is where he actually crossed the line from whistleblower and leaker to actually a traitor.
Wow. Well, a subject that is going to continue to develop, I gather you believe that it may well heat up if the Russians decide to expel him from his roost in their transit lounge in Moscow.
Yes. And there are indications that the Russians are losing a little bit of patience. It causes tensions with Washington that Moscow doesn't need at this moment. They've already gotten their public relations benefit by putting their thumb in our eye. And right now, because there are governments willing to take him, I think the Russians do want to turf him out. The issue, though, is going to be he can hide, but he can't run. The question is, how does he actually get to Venezuela or Bolivia or Cuba? And that's going to be difficult unless there's a special military transport to take him, because if he flies over Western European airspace, we will nab him one way or another.
Well, I was surprised, I must say, that the Bolivian president's aircraft was diverted in that airspace. I wouldn't have thought that possible, but it is evidence that at the very least, U.S. intelligence is pretty furious at this guy, and that may be causing the administration to take it very seriously as well. Gordon, let me turn to another topic we've touched on a bit in the past, but it got some more attention in the past week or so as President Obama visited Africa and made rather clear the competition that has emerged now between China and the United States on the African continent. He brought along some prodigious number of American businessmen for the purposes of trying to up our game there. How much of a competition actually is there at the moment, and what are the risks if we don't succeed?
Well, Africa probably is the new Asia. I think Asia's growth rates have really peaked, and there are a lot of problems in the region. But you look at Africa, which now has 5 of the world's fastest growing economies, 6 if you include Libya. So essentially, you're talking about a place which is really the next growth hotspot for the world. China has overtaken the U.S. as Africa's largest trading partner. That occurred in 2009, and now their trade is about double ours. When that's a cause of concern, of course, we still invest more in Africa than China does if you look at, let's say, a 5-year period. But nonetheless, we could lose out on that score as well. This was very important for the president to go to Africa. He did a fantastic job while he was there. He brought 500 business executives, and he promoted American democracy, which is really important because the three nations that he went to our democracies. So this, I think, was a very good trip on the part of the president, probably the best foreign policy we have seen in this administration so far.
Interesting. Well, obviously, much is to be determined by what happens next, whether we in fact see those businessmen taking up the challenge, whether, you know, the rule of law is sufficiently, you know, established and practiced there to make it more attractive than it proved to be in some parts of Asia, for sure, and how the Chinese will respond to any kind of assertion of our interests there as well. And Gordon, speaking of the Chinese and how they behave under the rule of law, talk a little bit about what you're picking up in terms of Chinese use of techniques to effectively undermine Western businesses that are doing business in China on price issues. Tell us how that's working and what the implications are.
Last week was stunning. Chinese regulatory agencies basically started price negotiations against foreign multinationals in three sectors, milk, medicines, and packaging. Almost all the targets were foreigners. And this is not to say that foreigners don't violate Chinese law when they're in China. Everybody does it. But the fact that only foreigners were targeted, I think, speaks that the Chinese government right now has decided that American and foreign companies are doing too well, and they're going to undermine us through price investigations. They're using their new anti-monopoly law, which is never applied against Chinese companies, only against foreign ones. This is a very bad story. President Obama needs to raise this when his Treasury Secretary and his Secretary of State meet the Chinese in Washington on Wednesday and Thursday of this week.
And do you anticipate that there will be pushback? And Gordon, is it enough to simply remonstrate with the Chinese at these high-level meetings, or does there need to be some kind of corresponding action taken to ensure that there's a, well, to coin a phrase, a price paid by them for behaving in this fashion?
Yeah, well, the more we talk to the Chinese, the worse their behavior gets. And this is important to understand that in China right now, you've got the economic turmoil, you've got disarray in the political system because they have not healed from the transition of last year. And so China's leaders cannot come to terms with the international community, much less us. Talking to the Chinese right now is not going to do any good, probably going to hurt things because we're feeding their already inflated notions of self-importance. What we need to do is impose consequences for completely irresponsible behavior. This administration has not gotten around to doing that in any meaningful way. Cybersecurity is at the top of the list of issues that need to be discussed. But more important, we need to impose consequences so that the Chinese have a reason to talk to us. Right now, they don't.
And Gordon, just very quickly, do you have something in mind in terms of an appropriate consequence for this price, you know, warfare against our companies?
I think the Blair-Huntsman Commission came up with the best proposal, which was 150% tariff on Chinese goods entering the United States. Once we impose that, the Chinese are going to get real responsible real fast. Unfortunately, there's no political will right now in Washington in either party to do that. But once we impose a tariff of that sort, I think our relations with China get better very quickly.
It'll be very interesting to watch how bad it hurts if we don't do that, and what appetite may as a result emerge for taking such sort of steps, draconian though they may be. Gordon Chang, we'll be watching that closely, as I know will you. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com and also Fox News, and a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much. Keep up the good work, sir. We'll talk with you next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.